MacCast, Tuesday, May 21st, 2019. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Hope you are having a great, awesome week. Things are going well here at MacCast HQ and in the world of Apple and Macintosh. We have quite a few things to talk about. Looking through the show notes today, we have actually new Macs to talk about. Yeah, some new Macs came into play. We're going to talk a little bit about Apple and cellular modems. Got some information about what went down with Qualcomm and Intel and all the others. Also going to talk about iPhone growth, a guest appearance at Apple Park, some famous musician showed up and played a concert there. We kind of alluded to that last week. LG monitors, what's going on with that? And Apple monitors, another thing we talked about on the last episode of the MacCast. Also some Apple Pay expansion and what's going on with Project Titan. That will round out the news for this week. And then we've got some great other topics to get into. We're going to talk about managing storage on your Mac and how to find all of the space that's being taken up. Help a listener out with a question related to that. Got a couple great tips, one about iOS and auto correction, also some Apple Watch tips, and then we'll round things out with a thing of the moment. We haven't done one of those in a while, and this one's a little bit different, not quite specifically Mac related, but something I've been using for a while that I've really enjoyed and I want to share with you. And that will round out this episode of the MacCast. So it should be a good one. Before we get into it, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor and a longtime running sponsor here on the MacCast, Smile. I want to talk to you about Text Expander, which is probably my favorite Smile application. I actually like them all. I actually use PDF Pen quite extensively as well. But Text Expander is something I definitely use each and every day. I love it because of how much time it saves me. I can just put together all my common sort of things that I need to type out. I have a lot of the responses for various questions I get here on the MacCast set up as Text Expander snippets and just type them in and boom, away it expands, saves me a ton of time. It is a useful tool, and I have to have it on every one of my Macs. If you've been listening to the MacCast and you don't have Text Expander yet, I find that hard to believe because we've been talking about it for years. Another great thing about Text Expander is that they are constantly updating it. They are constantly improving it, and it has all kinds of great features. They recently updated the editor, got a brand new editor. It makes it easier to see and edit things like fill-in fields, dates, math. Yeah, it can do a bunch of advanced things with your snippets as well, like automatically fill in a date or allow you to adjust the text with a fill-in field and a whole bunch more. You can also insert words, phrases, forms, templates, and even more with just a couple clicks wherever you are typing. Works in all of your applications on your Mac, and it really lets you take control of your time and productivity by handling all of those repetitive typing tasks. I love telling everybody about Text Expander, but if you are a Text Expander owner and you like doing that as well, you can also join their affiliate program and you'll get a little bit extra when someone purchases Text Expander for themselves. Best of all, here on the MacCast show, listeners, you get 20% off your first year of Text Expander. Just visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. This was actually the last story to come out in the news this week, but it was the first one I wanted to cover because I think it's the most exciting story of the week. Apple has updated their MacBook Pros. Yep, there are new MacBook Pros out there. And best of all, they have once again tweaked, I guess best of all, is that, maybe that's not the right thing to say. They've tweaked the butterfly keyboard design again. We got a fourth generation butterfly keyboard design. I guess in some ways it kind of proves that Apple has had some issues with that keyboard. We've been talking about that a lot here on the MacCast. But good news, if you're buying a new MacBook Pro, it means maybe those issues with stuck or unresponsive keys, those are a thing of the past. Let's hope. And as much as we're hoping, I bet you Apple is hoping even more that they've kind of licked this problem. But they continue to improve it, and I guess that's a good sign. The new updates are spec bumps specifically to the machines using the latest 8th and 9th generation core processors from Intel. The 15-inch model has new i7 and i9 6-core and 8-core options, and the 13-inch model gets updates with new i5 and i7 processors. The displays, ports, storage options, as well as the base pricing on the models does appear to have remained the same, so no big changes there. Again, bigger change is in that keyboard design, and as far as what Apple did, they're not giving a lot of details, but they did say that they changed the material in the butterfly mechanism and that that should substantially reduce problems that some users have seen. Don't talk about what materials have changed, although I have a feeling our friends over at iFixit will probably give us a little insight into what happened with the design. We might have to wait a couple days for that to happen, but expect it to happen soon, and we'll talk about what that is on a future episode of the MacCast. Along with the announcements of the new MacBooks, they did extend and add a couple of service programs. They extended the keyboard service program to cover the 2018 third generation models of those Apple keyboards, the ones in the MacBook Pro and MacBook Air from 2018. Those weren't part of that repair program previously, but they are now. So if you have one of those models and you are experiencing some of those unresponsive stuck key problems, Apple is going to take care of you. They also claim that they have shortened repair times, which were taking up to about a week. So I'm assuming that means a couple days now, maybe even quicker than that. We had heard that they were starting to do some of those repairs in store, and that should help speed up some of the times. Along with those repair programs, they're also reportedly replacing the third generation membrane keyboard. So if you do have one of those 2018 models, with new keyboards, the new designed one that is in the new model. Unfortunately, I think because of design differences, they won't be able to replace first or second generation ones with these new fourth generation designs. So that's something that is exclusive for the third generation models. And finally, keyboards are now covered up to 4 years after the original date of purchase. And that would be, again, for the first generation, second generation, or third generation butterfly keyboard designs. So if you do run into problems further down, you know, a few years from now, Apple is going to continue to take care of you. And then finally, one other service program that they did announce, backlight service program to address the flex cable issues that were affecting what Apple calls a very small percentage of 2016 13-inch MacBook Pro owners. So if you have a 2016 13-inch MacBook Pro sold between October 2016 and February 2018, and are experiencing problems with the display, I think specifically it's the, what they call it, the stage lighting effect along the bottom, where you kind of get hot spots along the bottom of the screen. Apple will address that with this backlight service program. So you can take your machine into an Apple Genius Bar, or you can contact Apple for service if you've run into that. And that's kind of the latest on the MacBook Pros. Another thing we've been talking about a lot recently is Apple and cellular modems. Specifically, there were, for a long time, concerns about how Apple was going to get 5G modems in future iPhones. Of course, Intel was struggling to provide those for Apple, and ultimately, Apple ended up settling with Qualcomm, which was something that was a little bit surprising, and not long after that, Intel announced that they were shuttering their cellular modem business. And so it all happened pretty quickly. We didn't have a lot of details on what went on. Well, the site, The Information, dug into things and gave us a lot more detail and information about how Apple struggled with Intel as a cellular modem provider. It turned out that, you know, Apple turned to Intel when they had that falling out with Qualcomm over licensing fees, and they were relying on Intel to kind of deliver the goods, and it really didn't work out too well. The switch to Intel ended up being rocky at best as Intel struggled to deliver what Apple needed and often missed deadlines. They started having troubles all the way back in 2017. We'd been hearing about it most recently with the iPhone XS series, but apparently, the issues started long before that. Basically, Intel's cellular modem business was kind of a mess, and that is ultimately what forced Apple to have to settle with Qualcomm. And that deal, as you remember, we talked about on the MacCast as well, did not go very well for Apple. Really, Qualcomm had the upper hand in this situation, and Apple just was left without any cards to play, and so they've gone back. We did know that Apple was trying to build up its own team internally to develop a cellular modem. Those efforts continue, and they reportedly have thousands of people working on that project. Originally, a lot of the rumors thought that Apple might have their own designs ready for a device as early as 2021, maybe by 2022. Well, this report from The Information also says that right now, Apple is, as they're conducting interviews for prospective engineers for the cellular modem team, they're telling those engineers they don't plan on having their own chips ready until about 2025. So that timeline's a little bit different. It's unclear why that may have changed. Apple may have been ready, and it may be part of the deal with Qualcomm, that they can't enter the cellular modem business, and so maybe that's the reason for the delay, or maybe they just weren't quite ready to have something on the market by 2021. We really don't know, but again, some interesting details coming out in this report. We have known for a while now that iPhone sales are slowing, and unfortunately, we continue to get additional evidence to back that up. This week, Consumer Intelligence Research Partners has new data on iPhone growth for the first quarter of 2019, and it shows that the installed base of U.S. iPhone owners grew about 2% over the last quarter, from 189 million to 193 million. That's about a 12% increase year over year. And while that sounds okay, it actually turns out to be growing at about half the rate that it was last year. So definitely slowing down. Apple looking at its business and trying to decide what's next. As we know from some of the recent announcements, of course, they're going to be focusing a lot on their services. And then we have all of these rumors about what maybe the next big thing is, something augmented reality, virtual reality related, possibly glasses or some sort of augmented reality display. We also know about their rumored car efforts, and we'll have some more information on that later in the podcast, but definitely more evidence that iPhone sales continue to just slow down. You may remember that last week I told you Apple was constructing a interesting stage at the center of the Apple Park campus, basically a rainbow in the original Apple logo colors. That turned out to be a stage for an upcoming event, and that event did happen this week. Apple held a party to commemorate the formal opening of the Apple Park campus, and that custom Apple stage with the original Apple rainbow logo design played a major role. I was also almost going to say, I kid you not, it was center stage at the event. That's terrible. I didn't mean to do that. Anyway, it was there, and the performer to perform on that stage was none other than Lady Gaga. She performed for 15,000 Apple employees, celebrating the campus opening and also as a tribute to Steve Jobs. During the concert, Lady Gaga asked Apple to create a Be Kind emoji. She also held a moment of silence for Steve and then dedicated a performance of the song Million Reasons to Jobs. And finally, she also thanked Zane Lowe for his support on Apple Music. Of course, the concert was well documented. A number of Apple employees, including Tim Cook himself, posted posted images and comments on social media, Instagram, Twitter, all those sorts of things. So you can check out those there. There was actually a full video of the concert, I think, up on YouTube at one point. And what was interesting was it was actually retweeted, by Lady Gaga herself. But when I went to actually watch that online, it was already pulled down for copyright issues from YouTube. So I'm not really sure what's going on there. I don't know if a copy of the video is out and available, but I would imagine you scour the internet enough, you probably can find a video of that concert. If I come across one, I will try to share a link to that in a future episode of the MacCast. But I'd like to see that. I think it looks like it was a fun concert just from the clips that I saw, and I think a great way to celebrate the opening of Apple Park. I guess we have a lot of follow-up in this week's MacCast. Actually, last week, we discussed the LG Ultrafine 4K and 5K displays that were slowly disappearing, or I guess not just slowly, they'd been over the years disappearing from Apple's retail stores and their online stores. Most recently, they stopped selling the 5K displays online, and there were theories that Apple had been clearing those monitors out for the pending future launch of their own Pro 6K display that we've been hearing about and talking about here on the MacCast. Well, now, thanks to tidbits, it looks like maybe they were just clearing out to make room for another version or an updated version of the LG Ultrafine display. Apparently now some Apple retail stores are carrying a new $700 US 23.7-inch Ultrafine LG display. It looks like it's one that replaces the 4K display. It comes in at a resolution of 3840 by 2160, which is actually a little bit less than the 21.5-inch ultrafine 4K display it replaced, which had a resolution of 4096 by 2304. But it still is in line with the Ultra HD resolution 4K displays that are on the market. So it qualifies as a 4K display, even if the resolution is a little bit less. And just like the previous model, it also has two Thunderbolt 3 ports on it, along with three regular USB-C ports. So it does have pass-through Thunderbolt, which is great news, and it sounds like a really great monitor. Definitely a replacement for that 21.5-inch at the same price, so you get a little bit more display. You're not paying any more than you were previously if you were interested in the LG Ultrafine displays. Of course, Apple does have that 6K display on the market. Probably going to come in at a much higher price point, though. We don't know when that is going to happen, although we are expecting a possible announcement and maybe Apple showing that off at Worldwide Developer Conference in June. But we're just going to have to wait for that. But for now, you can apparently go in and purchase this new 23.7-inch ultrafine LG display. Apple continues to expand Apple Pay into more countries. I believe last week we told you about the expansion into Iceland. Now, this week they have launched in Hungary and Luxembourg with support for credit cards and debit cards from MasterCard, Visa, and support from some regional banks. Apple Pay in Hungary supports MasterCard via OTP Bank, and in Luxembourg, you can use MasterCard credit and debit cards along with Visa and Visa's VPay cards from BGL BNP Paribas. So if you're in those regions, Apple Pay is available. I'd love to hear any feedback from how the rollout is going in these various countries. We don't get a lot of international feedback here on the MacCast, but I know there are many of you out there. So if you want to write in or email in an audio comment or something, let us know how Apple Pay rollouts are going internationally. That would be awesome. As for who is next, ING has already teased support for a future Apple Pay launch in the Netherlands. So that launch is very likely going to be the next one you'll hear about here on the MacCast. Finally, in the news for this week, Project Titan lives. The Titan lives. A financial analyst at Roth Capital Partners claims that Apple is building, quote, multiple very large drive rooms in California. I'm not entirely sure what a drive room is. I need to do some research on that. If you work in the industry and know what that is, if you could let us know, shoot me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. The analyst says Apple is building the rooms to actually work on better battery technology for their continued efforts on a car project. So something related to batteries, but they didn't really get into specifics. He also specifically said that, quote, Project Titan is absolutely not dead. And for those of you who may not remember, again, Project Titan is Apple's rumored autonomous electric vehicle car project. We never got a clear answer on whether it was an electric vehicle or autonomous. I'm imagining that it's likely both. He also said that back in 2013, Apple actually made a serious bid to buy Tesla. It's unclear how far those efforts actually went, but apparently Apple was looking to pony up some very serious cash, paying a stock price even higher than Tesla's current stock price is today. They were willing to do that. Whether or not Tesla was even interested in Apple's advances, that's really unclear. I think at the time, Elon Musk had sort of been asked about it and basically said, no, there's no way they would sell to Apple. So maybe that just never really went anywhere. But apparently Apple was mulling it over. And we do know around that time that Tim Cook and some of the other Apple executives did have meetings with Tesla. So something was possibly going on, but of course, nothing ever came of it. As far as where Apple's current autonomous vehicle car project efforts are now, they seem to be investing and spending money in it. They've been hiring engineers. They continue to work on it. As far as the publicly facing things that we actually do know about and have seen, we do know that Apple has used some Lexus SUV models here in California as kind of a test bed for some of their autonomous vehicle systems. Tim Cook has come out publicly and said that Apple is working on autonomous systems. But beyond that, that's about all we have actually seen or can really confirm. There also have been rumors of something called the Palo Alto to Infinite Loop project, or the PAIL project. That is supposedly a autonomous vehicle shuttle system that Apple would develop for Apple employees, something, again, that they would use to test internally their autonomous vehicle systems. That's where the project's at. Of course, it could be one of Apple's next big things. For my part, I'm going to still stay sitting out here on my limb and say that I think Apple is seriously considering developing a vehicle as a service project. So, a whole system where they would have a fleet of autonomous vehicles in all kinds of locations that you could subscribe to and basically have an on-demand car service provided to you. So you wouldn't have to purchase a vehicle, you wouldn't have to get insurance, or you would not have to pay vehicle maintenance or any of those sorts of things. That would all be covered in your vehicle as a service program. And I know I get a lot of feedback from people on this who say there's no way that people, especially in California, are going to give up their vehicles. I see this more as a supplemental service. So a lot of folks have two, maybe three cars. This would allow them to reduce the number of vehicles that they actually own by one. And of course, some people would just rely on it completely as a service. But I kind of see that as the future, that more and more people are going to use services like that. If you talk to a lot of younger people right now, you'll find a lot of them are already using car services like Uber or Lyft as their only mode of transportation. So that's becoming more and more common. I think the next logical step beyond that is you just have autonomous vehicles that are at your beck and call. And I think that is something that Apple might be considering. Again, we don't really know what direction they're moving in, but they're obviously looking at a number of different options and developing technologies and services that will go in and around that kind of service. So it should be interesting to see. I think we're years off from getting any of that. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment and thank another couple show sponsors, starting with Experian Boost. Hey, you know, the better your credit score, the easier it is to get the stuff you want, or the less you'll have to pay for the stuff you want. But the question is, how do you raise your credit score? For the first time ever, Experian Boost provides you a way to raise your credit score by doing something that you're actually already doing, simply paying your bills like your utilities and your cell phone. Personally, for me, I have pretty good credit right now, but it took me years to get it that way. Some bad decisions early on when I was, young took that pretty low, and it was pretty hard to improve those scores. It literally took years for me to be able to do that. With Boost, you can actually increase your credit score instantly, and best of all, Boost is free and only available from Experian. You're already paying bills like gas, water, electric, cable, your cell phone bill. You're doing all that stuff on time. So actually, why shouldn't you get credit for that on your credit score? With Boost, you actually will. Best of all, using Boost is easy. You can sign up in minutes. And again, you can increase your credit score instantly. As a matter of fact, most people who Boost increase their scores by more than 10 points. It's amazing, actually, that it's taken so long for someone to do this. Boost your FICO score instantly for free. Boost is only available at Experian.com/MacCast. That's Experian.com/MacCast. Experian.com/MacCast. Check it out today. And a big thank you to Experian Boost for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to thank Linode for their support of the MacCast. Hey, if you need a server, Linode allows you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. You can get a server up and running in seconds with your choice of Linux operating system, resources, and also in your choice of 10 different node locations. Best of all, they are giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. You can actually set up any kind of server you want for any reason. I've actually been wanting to set up a Minecraft server. Yeah, I don't really talk about it too much on the MacCast, but I'm a Minecraft fan. And Linode made it super easy to do in one click. They have one click installs for all kinds of gaming applications, also all kinds of other applications like WordPress, Drupal, GitLab, OpenVPN. Yeah, you want to run your own VPN server? You can do that on Linode. They also have a game installs for other games like Ark, Terraria, and more. Plus, they offer a whole bunch of Linux distros. If it runs on Linux, basically it runs on Linode. Most Linux distributions are available out of the box, but you can also upload custom images or even create your own. Basically, they can build whatever server you want, and they feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. And best of all, like I said, they have a number of locations you can pick from, 10 different data centers worldwide, and they just recently opened their newest data center in Toronto, Canada, built using their most up-to-date hardware and their next-generation network backbone. It allows users to comply with in-country data protection requirements while taking advantage of all of Linode's technologies and tools. Plus, they're opening an additional data center in Mumbai, India, by the end of 2019. Another great thing about Linode is pricing is simple with no surprises. You actually pay for what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and their add-on services. You can get what you need from Linode with a $5 a month Nanode plan, and you can go all the way up to high-powered dedicated CPU plans as well. And their dashboard makes it totally easy to manage your Linodes and upgrade your plan when and how you need to. As a matter of fact, you can add on backups, large storage volumes, even load balancing. And if you need support, they have 24/7 live customer support and a large documentation library that provides a great resource for when you get stuck. Visit linode.com/MacCast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit when you use the promo code MacCast2019. That's linode.com/MacCast, and make sure to use the code MacCast2019 to get your $20 credit. And a big thank you to Linode for their support of the MacCast. Phil wrote in this week with a common question that I get here on the MacCast, and probably something you've maybe heard either yourself or maybe a friend or family member say, and that is, what the heck happened to all my storage on my Mac? Like, where did my storage go? And more we hear it these days because in the age of SSDs, a lot of us have actually downgraded our storage. You know, we used to have 1, 2, 4 terabytes of data, and now we're down to maybe 256 or 512 gigabytes or something like that. And storage is precious. And so you're looking through your stuff and you're going, wow, I only have, 20 gigabytes free. Where am I going to stick all my things? And that's kind of what Phil ran into. He was looking at his storage, doing some analysis with some tools, and said, I don't know where my storage went. He has a 2013 13-inch Retina MacBook Pro, I think it was, and he's got a 250-gigabyte SSD, about 40 gigabytes of that free. And so he thought, I'm going to run Omni Disk Sweeper on it and see where that storage went. And it ended up making things even more confusing for Phil. And I'm sorry about that, Phil, because after he ran the tool, it only accounted for about 136 gigabytes of his stuff, but he obviously had a lot more than that on his drive. And so he asked me the question, where did it all go? And before you write in to tell me, hey, Time Machine local snapshots, something we've talked about here on the MacCast in the past, Phil already disabled Time Machine local snapshots and removed them. For those of you who don't remember what Time Machine local snapshots are, if you use Time Machine, especially if you use Time Machine with a mobile Mac, anytime you're disconnected from your Time Machine drive, you're out and about, or if you're using Time Machine over the network, anytime you're away from your home network, when Time Machine needs to run, what it will do is it will, if there is available storage, it will use a portion of the internal drive on your Mac to actually perform those Time Machine backups. And then when you get back to your home network, it syncs those things up with your actual Time Machine volume. So it's kind of this temporary interim place where when you're out and about and not physically connected to your Time Machine drive, your Mac can actually still perform some Time Machine backups and keep some history. And so often, that'll be the thing that's taking up a lot of space. The thing is that's what Apple calls purgeable space. So if you did need to get more stuff onto your Mac, that wouldn't restrict you from having access to that available storage. But when you're looking through various tools and stuff like that, it shows up as unavailable space. So it can often be very confusing. But that wasn't what was happening in Phil's case. I actually found a post over on the Mac Observer where Dave Hamilton noticed some mixed results with the tool Omni Disk Sweeper. I'll have a link to that in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, the problem is in the age of sandboxing and the new permissions that are in Mac OS, a lot of applications and tools like this don't necessarily have the permissions to be able to access all of the portions of your hard drive that they would need to perform their kind of analysis. And I guess Omni Disk Sweeper is struggling with this a little bit. So it doesn't see all the files in Mac OS. And for some of the ones that it can't get to, it just simply ignores them and doesn't report on them. It also seems like some of the data that it excludes are things like your mail data, which can be huge if you have, large email accounts and you save a lot of emails. So likely, Phil, the problem is that by running Omni Disk Sweeper, you're actually just not seeing all of the files that are on your system. So one bit of advice would be to try another tool. Actually, my favorite tool for looking at disk usage is Daisy Disk. I think it's absolutely awesome. I love the visual display that it gives you and the ability to kind of drill in and look at different portions of your hard drive, different categories of data, and see what's taking up that data. It actually has the ability to add full disk access permission to allow it to actually go in and see some of those hidden files or the files and data that normally you can't do. So when you run Daisy Disk, you will see a big portion that it calls hidden space the first time you do the analysis. But if you go into the hidden space, it gives you a link that says, hey, allow Daisy Disk to have full disk access from system preferences, security, and privacy, and I'll be able to actually go in and analyze and tell you what's in that hidden space. So I think that hidden space is where you're not seeing a lot of things, Phil. So try Daisy Disk, and I think that'll help you out. Also, another great tool is Clean My Mac. They have a great large and old files tool that allows you to go in and see, you know, which things are taking up a lot of disk space and decide if you want to clean those things up. So those are two tools that you can look into. But one thing I wanted to recover here on the MacCast, because it's been a while since we talked about it, is some of the great information and tools that are built right into your Mac. You don't even need a third-party utility, possibly, to kind of analyze the storage on your Mac. If you go into your Apple menu, choose About My Mac, and then go to the Storage tab of the About My Mac window, give it a second to kind of build up its little graph, and you can hover over the different sections to kind of get a rough idea of what kinds of files are taking up space on your Mac. So like when I do mine here on my Mac, I can see that a big portion of my storage is used up by photos. And that's not surprising. I am using iCloud Photo Library, but this Mac is set up to be kind of my master repository of my photo library. So that is by far the biggest portion of my storage. But I can also see, you know, how much is being used up by documents, how much is being used up by iOS files, which would be my like my iOS backups, and that is actually a significant portion. I can even see things like my Parallels volumes, you know, my VMware volumes and virtual volumes, and see how much storage those are using, or iCloud Drive, or how much the system is using. And that gives you kind of a quick overview, but also in the same window, you have a little manage button. And if you click on the manage button, that gives you some additional tools and additional information to see specifically what kinds of categories of data are, you know, being used up on your hard drive. And you can kind of drill through those. So you can look at, you know, how many applications do I have installed and how much storage are those apps using? Or my iBooks files, or I can look at my iTunes files, or my mail. How much is mail using up? In my case, 9 gigabytes, because I rely a lot on email, as you might imagine. We get a lot of emails here at the MacCast. So that's taking up a lot of storage. So you can drill in and you can look at that. And best of all, inside that view, they give you some additional sorting options. Not only can you go sort of by category, but within those categories, you can look at the size, of course, and sort by size to see which are the bigger files. But you can also then look at the last accessed date. So if you're looking at your applications, you can see, oh, this application's using, you know, a couple gigabytes of storage, but I haven't actually launched or used that application in 3 years. Well, maybe that's an app that you might consider just uninstalling. Maybe you just don't need that application anymore. Same thing for your documents. If you've got large documents or large files, maybe a video file, maybe it's something you can actually archive to a different location, get it off your internal drive, especially if it's something that you're not accessing frequently. So it provides all of this kind of information. It also gives you some tools to actually delete files. I tend to avoid that delete button inside this view just because I'm not entirely certain where that file is in my system. Now, actually at the bottom, it does show you a path, so you actually can look, but I think it's easier to look in the Finder. So what I like to do is if I find a large file or a file I think I can either archive or delete or remove, I'll usually select that in this interface and then click the Show in Finder button. And then I can go directly to the Finder. I can kind of analyze it, look at it there. And just for me, that makes me a little bit more comfortable. This tool also has a downloads button, so it'll show you items in your downloads folder when you're in the documents view, and also a full file browser that looks a little bit more like the Finder itself, and you can kind of drill down and see different folder sizes, different volume sizes, and file sizes and stuff like that. So I think it's kind of a handy tool. It's not the best tool out there. You know, some of the third-party tools provide a little bit more functionality, but as a basic tool just to kind of figure out, hey, what's taking up all my space, this is a good one. And as a matter of fact, I think a great tab in this view is the iOS iOS Files tab. This is something that a lot of people don't think about. So if you've been using your Mac with various iOS devices, maybe several versions or generations of iPhones that you've had or iPads, anytime you connect to your Mac, your iTunes pulls a backup of that device. You might have a lot of iOS backups for old devices that maybe you don't even own anymore. And those could be taking up a lot of storage on your system. And if you look at the iOS Files section, you'll actually see that. It will show you those backups and you can kind of manage them from there. Also, mail is another big culprit, especially old attachments. And this managed storage system information area does give you some options for dealing with mail attachments as well. So, Phil, I would give this tool a try. See if that doesn't provide a little bit more detail about what's going on your Mac and what's taking up all the storage and help you manage it a little bit. If that's not enough, I would seriously consider and look at picking up a copy of Daisy Disk. So I hope this information helps you out, and thanks for sending in your email. Another thing I saw this week was a great tip about hardware keyboards on iOS devices. This was actually posted by Andrew Orr over at the Mac Observer. I will have a link to his article in the show notes at maccast.com, and he actually found this tip on OS X Daily, which is a great tips website. I will have a link to this article at OS X Daily as well in the show notes at maccast.com. And just in general, os10daily.com is a great website to check out for general Mac tips and stuff like that. So check that out. But in this case, if you've ever used a hardware keyboard with your iPad, you know that one of the challenges can often be autocorrect. Autocorrect can sometimes be, let's just say, overly aggressive about correcting things, and sometimes it doesn't always correct stuff in the way that you want. Did you know there's actually a separate setting for hardware keyboards when they're connected for controlling things like autocorrection? Yeah, I didn't know this either until I saw Andrew's article. As a matter of fact, with a hardware keyboard connected to your iPad, you can open up the settings and go into general and then go into keyboards, and you should see, if the keyboard is connected, a hardware keyboards section. If you tap on that, you can go in and adjust the toggle for auto correction and set that to off, and that will disable auto correction for this iPad or the iPad that you're connected to when a hardware keyboard is attached. And it is a separate setting for the hardware keyboard versus the software keyboard that is on the device. Optionally, there's some other hardware-specific keyboard settings that you can go in and adjust here as well. I'll let you go in and discover those for yourself, so play around with that. Of course, exit the settings, and then you will have the new options for your hardware keyboard. And I thought that was pretty cool. Nice little tip, little quick tip for you here on the MacCast. Want to give you another couple tips, this time for your Apple Watch, and this time coming from an article over at Macworld. Now, they did a bunch of these. I kind of picked out some of my favorites, more specifically, some of the ones that I didn't know already. There's about 12 tips over at Macworld. I'll have a link to the article in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to check out some of these others. But a few of my favorites and ones that I didn't really know about or didn't remember are things like, did you know you don't have to deal with that tiny little bubble app grid for launching apps on your Apple Watch? There actually is another view. There is a list view that you can get to. So if you go into that little app grid by, you know, tapping the digital crown on your Apple Watch to pull up your app grid and force touch on that grid, you will get the option to switch between the grid view and the list view. And you might find that the list view is a little bit handier for figuring out what an app is, because it actually has the name of the app in the list. With the little bubble grid, you have to kind of go off the icon, and sometimes it's hard to figure out what those little icons are. So this is a nice alternative, and that's how you access that. Another feature that you probably know about is if you want to mute or disable your Apple Watch screen, you can actually just put your hand over the top of it, cover it up, and that will instantly mute the Apple Watch. So if you're getting a call or something's happening and you just want to silence it, just put your hand over it. Did you know you can actually disable that feature if you don't like that? Yeah, you can actually disable the cover to mute option. Go into the Watch app on your iPhone. So for this one, you got to go through the Watch app on your iOS device and go into Sound and Haptics under the My Watch tab, and you'll see a toggle for the cover to mute option. So you can disable that or enable that at your will. This next one is pretty cool. I often actually answer calls on my Apple Watch. And actually, this is a pair of tips that might be handy. Did you know you can actually send a call straight to voicemail from your Apple Watch? So if you have an incoming call, just double tap the side button, not the digital crown, but the actual side button, and that will instantly send that call straight to voicemail. You can also answer that call on your iPhone, not just the Apple Watch. So I often will answer it on my Apple Watch and then transfer it to my iPhone. If you have your iPhone nearby and handy, but maybe can't grab it immediately and want to just send it from your Apple Watch to the iPhone, instead of hitting the hang up or answer button on the watch itself, simply swipe up on your Apple Watch as you're receiving that call, and then you will have an option to tap the answer on iPhone button. And you can hit that, and it will send the call over to your iPhone. You can pick it up from there. So that's another handy little tip. There's also the fast app switcher tip. So if you want to quickly switch between the current app and the Apple Watch face, if you just double tap the digital crown, you can toggle between that. You can also toggle between a couple of apps, although I'm not entirely sure how you get two apps open at the same time. But if you do, you can just double tap on the digital crown to switch between those. In my case, every time I tried this tip, it just went between the open app and the digital crown, or the digital crown, the main Apple Watch face itself. And that worked great. And then another great tip is finding your iPhone. So rather than using Find My iPhone or getting a friend to use Find My iPhone for you, or another one that we often do in my house is having someone else in your household call your phone. If you have an Apple Watch, it does have a ping feature. So if you simply swipe up on the control center, there's a little iPhone ping button. It looks like a little iPhone with sound lines coming out of it. If you tap that, it will ping your iPhone. And I actually knew this tip. It's something that I use quite frequently, but I forget to use very often as well. A lot of times I'll ask my wife to call my phone and then remember, oh, I could have just pinged it from my Apple Watch. So I'll forget about this feature. So this just serves as a good reminder. But even cooler is a tip in here that I didn't know about related to this feature. And that is that rather than just tapping that ping iPhone button, if you actually tap and hold on that button, not only will it ping your phone, but it will also flash the LED on your phone. So if you're trying to find your phone in the dark, this can be a really handy way to do it. So I didn't know that was a feature, and I thought that was pretty cool. So there you have it, a couple really cool iPhone or Apple Watch tips, rather, from Macworld. And again, I'll have a link to the full article in the show notes at maccast.com. Last thing that I have for you today is a thing of the moment, an Apple product or Apple-related product that I am enjoying using, having a good time with. This can also sometimes be a software thing or maybe even just a software tip, something that I'm into that is Apple or iOS-related. Well, this time around, it is not something particularly new, but something that I realized as I was getting ready to do the podcast today, I hadn't told you about, and something that I am really truly enjoying because it brings comfort specifically to my ears. And I'm talking about something related to my podcast headphones. So I have a set of headphones, over-the-ear ones that I use for recording the podcast. They are studio headphones from Audio-Technica, specifically the ATH-M 40X model. I absolutely love these studio monitor headphones. They're great. I've had them for years. They are reasonably priced for studio monitoring headphones at around $100. So they're not cheap, but they are great headphones. But those are not my pick, although they would be a good pick, and I probably have picked them in the MacCast in the past. I've probably made them a thing of the moment. If not, just consider this a double bonus. They are great headphones if you're looking for something like that. But I've been using these headphones for so long, or had been using them for so long, that literally the ear pads were disintegrating. I started to find these little black flecks of something in my hair, and it turned out to be the coating from the pads that were on my headphones. So every time I would record the podcast, I'd have this like black dandruff. It was pretty disgusting. And I couldn't figure it out for the longest time. And then I realized, oh, these things are like literally falling apart. And I didn't want to buy a whole new set of headphones because that's kind of expensive at $100. And really, it was just the ear pads. So I went searching for some new ones, and I found ones from a company called Wicked Cushions at wickedcushions.com. I actually found them on Amazon. They were not inexpensive, about $20, but the thing is they're really high quality and they are so comfortable. They are a memory foam covered in a soft leather material, and they are a lot thicker than the original ear pads or ear cups. I don't know if you call them pads or cups or whatever, but they were super easy to install. I took the old ones off, I put the new ones on, and I have loved them ever since. And I thought, now that I have them, I should have replaced the stock pads years ago because they were kind of thin. They were fine, but these are soft and supple and completely comfortable and just amazing. And I realized I hadn't shared that with you here on the MacCast. So it's called Wicked Cushions, wickedcushions.com. And they don't just have them for the Audio-Technica headphones. They also offer them for other headphone models as well. Beats, Bose, Sony, Vmoda. They have a bunch of different options. So if you have another brand of over-the-ear headphones and you're looking for some ear cup, ear pad replacements, I would highly recommend these. And again, you can find them also on Amazon. I'm sure they're available other places as well. So that's my pick of the moment, Wicked Cushions. And with that, hey, that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all of Smile's great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at CacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. A comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on the future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline. Excuse me, that phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.